Hello!
Hi, and welcome to the very first episode of the Frogs Bollocks podcast. Now, I know what you're thinking. Why on earth would you call a podcast the Frogs Bollocks? I mean, it's a bit of an out there name, but hey, it got your attention and you're here listening and having fun with us. So welcome to the podcast. It's all about coming together to celebrate the weird, the wonderful, the big, the small animals that we get to share our beautiful planet with. And we're hoping it's going to be informative, but also really entertaining and conversational. And every episode, we're going to feature a special guest, a scientist, a conservationist, a ranger, someone with an interesting story or perspective to tell. So I'm really excited about that one.
Yes, we also want to hear from you guys, our dear listeners. So if you have any funky stories, some wacky questions, or some interesting theories, then please do get in touch by emailing us at info@thefrogsbollocks.com. Now, we're going to be releasing an episode every single Friday, but to start with, we're going to give you two episodes for the price of one.
Aren't you lucky?
So, shall we introduce ourselves?
I guess so. I think that's nearly admin done. So yeah, let's say who we are.
So we are a couple.
Yeah, I'd say that's...
Still?
Yeah, yes.
Despite many arguments about the podcast?
No, I wouldn't say arguments.
Debates?
Oh, you know, conversations.
Heated debates?
No.
You threw many plates across the room and smashing glasses and honestly, I'm battered and bruised.
You can't start a podcast.
Oh, I've done it now.
You're battered and bruised. It's not the way this is going to work.
Shall we introduce one another as like a bonding exercise? You introduce me, I'll introduce you.
Right, well, after what you've just said, I'm not sure I want to. I can introduce you in the worst way possible. No, I wouldn't really, because I'm a nice person. So, James Stevens, you are a wonderful wildlife filmmaker. You're also a brilliant photographer as well and an all-round naturalist. You've guided in Scotland and further afield for a really long time. You're just so passionate about wildlife and the environment, and you're brilliant at sharing that with lots of wonderful people. But as well as that, you're actually a really good musician. You're very good at guitar. You're very good at singing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You are. No, you are.
Very generous to say.
Well, you're very humble about it and very shy about it, but it is very true. And yeah, we met in 2021 at a Spring Watch rap party where it was kind of through lockdown. So you'd filmed and I presented, but we didn't get to meet because obviously lockdown, the black hole that no one shall mention. And then, yeah, kind of got together and been kind of making wildlife film stories ever since.
That was nice. I thought you were going to be really mean.
No, well, I'm not mean. I'm a nice person, like I said, with a nice, kind personality.
Well, we shall see with my description. Megan McCubbin is a naturalist, zoologist, TV presenter, most known for Spring Watch and Animal Park. She studied zoology at the University of Liverpool and has since gone on to do loads of amazing things across the world. She went to Bimini to study sharks. She went to China to volunteer her time for the bear rehabilitation, so for bears who were involved in the illegal bear bar industry. Her passion for nature is infectious, which is what makes her such a brilliant science and wildlife communicator. And it's why she's so successful in the field that she works in. She's an all-round nature nut. And yeah, we're both very excited.
I mean, it's very nice, but you've been giving me the most intense stare. I know, giving that list the whole time.
I was sort of thinking, do I be really mean here? But no, I was doing really nice things.
So thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll save that for later.
Yeah. Now, many of you have already been writing in addressing a very important question for the podcast. Now, Megan McCubbin, are you ready for question number one? Official question number one.
Okay, go on.
Do frogs actually have bollocks?
Ah, oh, that age-old question that is always on everybody's mind. The amount of times I've woken up and thought, oh, do frogs have bollocks? Well, let me tell you the answer to that. Yes, they do. Male frogs have testicles, but they don't have them externally like we do as mammals. They have them internally. And they're nestled up right next to the kidneys. So, yes, frogs do have bollocks. It can be quite tricky to sex males and females because the testicles are internal. So one way to tell the difference is that females are typically bigger and the males have something called nuptial pads on their hands, which are like these Velcro-y pads. They're quite thick. And that enables them to grab onto the back of the female really tightly and cling on, especially because they live in a wet, slippery environment. So the last thing you want to do is fall off your female. So yes, frogs do have bollocks, very important, but they are quite small next to the kidneys.
Shall we discuss the theme? because I've been working behind the scenes here at our home, and I've been creating something for you to listen to.
No, okay.
You've not heard this before.
Right.
But I've created a handful of theme tunes for you to choose from.
For the podcast?
For the podcast.
Okay.
The Frogs Bollocks official theme tune, which you get to select of the four that I've made.
Under the pressure.
And you're not allowed to judge. You're not allowed to laugh because this is obviously very, very serious. Are you ready for theme number one?
I don't know. I can't believe this is what you've been doing in here all this time. The door locked and the blinds closed.
It's taken me a very long time. Are you ready?
Okay,
number
go
one.
On.
The frog.
The frog.
The frog.
The frogs.
Bollocks.
Okay.
Yeah? Thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you went hard with it. You went full on in Frogs Bollocks.
Yeah.
You know, operatic.
Yeah, quite. Acapella. Acoustic.
Acapella, that's the word for it. Okay. Yeah, I like it. I like it. It's quite. Yeah. I like the ribbit, but.
You like the ribbit? Thanks.
I like the ribbit at the end.
The bit at the end, which is nothing musical, just me imitating a frog.
But I thought that's a bit I could do because I can't. I'm not musical.
Okay.
So I could add that.
Yeah.
I can imitate a frog.
We'll get that added on.
Okay. Go on. Next one.
Next one.
Frogs, 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 the frogs bollocks.
Rabbit.
It's the rabbit at the end. Rabbit.
I think it's quite a good rabbit.
Yeah, no, it is. It's, yeah, it's not bad. I think I prefer the first one.
Okay, fine.
But I do like it.
Right, let's do the fourth one and then go back to the third one. Basically, between doing the second and the fourth one, I had a bit of a, not really a breakdown, but I just had a bit of a moment. So let's skip ahead. Let's do the fourth one.
Okay.
Frogs Bollocks, yeah.
Rabbit.
Just the rabbit at the end. I feel like you've gone Beyonce on me.
Beyonce?
Yeah, because she's gone country.
Yeah. I mean, you know? I've always been likened to Beyonce, so this is, you know, it's quite right. Nice to have that instilled. Now, you mentioned Beyonce. The last one is actually more of a song.
Okay.
So I was going down, like, theme tunes, and then I started playing a few chords, and they started sounding quite good, and then I had some ideas of lyrics in my head, and I basically went down a massive rabbit hole and wrote a song. Well, I wrote a half of a song.
How long is this half of a song?
It's only about a minute.
Okay.
You ready?
I'm not sure, but go on.
I'm so scared already.
Once there was a little frog, oh so sad, dreaming of the life they could never have, desperately looking up to the sky. Without the wings they could not fly, a hop, a bounce just took so long. If only they had legs with which to run, run away from its little pond, and out to the great bigger world beyond. But instead they had a light inside, a little glint of hope in their eyes, some words lodged deep in their mind, telling them they're special. You are, 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 the frog's bollocks. You are, 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 the frog's bollocks.
What do you think? Hey, this is serious. You're just liking me to Beyonce.
Initially, I was really emotional. I was like, oh, this little frog in his little pond, dreaming of the wider world beyond.
Yeah. Oh, that's the next verse.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, stop it. I mean, I think you've done it.
Yeah. I mean, that can't be the theme tune. That's
no,
long.
But you could do the you are, you are, you are, you are, the frog's bollocks.
You are, you are, you are, you are, the frog's bollocks.
Rabbit. I think.
Done.
I think we should play out with this every episode.
Yeah.
And I reckon we should go for number one.
The frogs.
The frogs.
The frogs.
The frogs. Ballet.
Yeah. What do you think? Are you?
I'm very. As long as you're happy, I'm very happy. I'm just really glad you don't want me to do it again because it took a long time.
Yeah, well, I came in to bring you a drink when you were doing it, and you told me off.
I know. I don't like you hearing me sing. It's scary.
Yeah, but I just heard you sing then.
It's different. I've had it auto-tuned to the max, so that helps.
That's what you sound like. Yeah. Heard, do you know what? You don't like to sing in front of me, but you'll sing Shrek in the shower perfectly fine.
Oh, yeah, Disney.
At the top of your lungs.
Anything like that, I'm more than happy to sing. And I like to do impressions,
as you know.
So yeah. I can do all the characters. So basically, West End, London, I'm ready. I've done The Lion King. I can do Timon, Pumbaa. I can do all of them. So whenever you're ready.
I can vouch for that. Take him. Take him.
So as well as researching frog testicle facts, what other wildlife stuff have you been up to?
Well, that did take up a lot of my week, especially researching that in the middle of a busy cafe, getting really weird looks from the tables next door, and I had big photos of frog testicles up on my laptop screen. But hey, that's what we do. No, it's been a really good week, actually. Came back up to Scotland, settled in, just a bit of escapism out back into the wild. But sometimes the best wildlife encounters you can have are in your backyard, and I'm a big advocate for that wherever you live in the UK. But up in Scotland, like, we're so lucky with the wildlife here. And one evening, we were settling down, weren't we, for the evening, watching a bit of telly, when something caught our eye out the back door. Mm. And we had a pine marten in the garden at the squirrel feeder, gorging itself on peanuts.
Oh, we are so lucky. I mean, we've kind of done it on purpose. We've tried to attract as much wildlife in our garden as possible. We've put loads of different bird feeders in. We put a pond and we put the squirrel feeders up.
Yeah.
And yeah, it makes full use of that at nighttime.
I know. It's amazing to have this animal coming and going. Obviously very elusive. But I do think there are a couple coming to the garden every night, perhaps, or at least every week. And of course, you can tell individuals apart. There's size differences between males and females. Males typically a lot larger. Sometimes there are variations in the patterns, the markings. So pine martens have got a white bib, and sometimes it can be speckled with brown dots. And those can be as individual as our fingerprints. It's one way to tell them apart. But it'd be great just to get a wildlife camera and figure out who's visiting our garden in the evening.
Yeah, we need to do it. I don't know why we haven't done it yet, but that's a plan for this week. Let's get a trail cam out and start identifying the pine martens.
You know, one time though, a couple of years ago, you were off filming in Africa and I was on FaceTime to my mum. And from where I sit on the sofa, I can kind of see out through the kitchen and through the back door. And I had the door open because it was a really beautiful, warm summer's evening. It was only about 6 p.m. And I noticed this little face with this beautiful button nose peeking round the door frame. And without a word of a lie, it took a few steps into the kitchen. And it was a pine marten. And I nearly lost it. And I turned the phone camera around so that my mum could see, because I was on FaceTime to her having a catch up. And, you know, she didn't do the typical thing of like, oh my God, it's amazing. Look, it's cute. Her reaction to this pine marten was, ah! She shrieked really loudly, and of course this poor thing just darted away and I didn't get to see it again for a couple of months.
Classic Joanne, that is.
Yeah,
classic.
Thanks, Mum.
Joe.
Thanks, Mum. Thanks a lot.
No, I was incredibly jealous when you sent that photo to me whilst I was away. I was like, oh, of all the times for the pine marten to come inside the house. I mean, we didn't encourage it in the house, but they're very inquisitive and just thought, right, what's for dinner?
And I was a bit smug, to be honest.
I know you were. Very smug. So I can't really trump pine martens. I have been out on the hills trying to film mountain hare and got some good shots. But actually, similar to yours, my wildlife highlight this week was a little bird in our garden. Mm. On the feeders was a goldcrest.
Yeah.
Really weird. I've never seen a goldcrest on feeders before. And this has been around for a few days and just been munching away at the fat balls and the peanuts. And it's just crazy.
Yeah. And it's been really confident as well. We've been able to get quite close to it, which I was quite surprised at. Because normally these tiny little birds are so flitting and flitty and flyy and fast in the hedgerow.
Exactly.
In the bushes. You never really get as good a look as what we've had. It's
no,
been
we've
amazing.
Been literally like a meter away from it, and it's just been not bothered at all. Now, I think it must be gaining some energy, ready for its migration back to mainland Europe. You know, we have a resident population of goldcrests, but in the winters and autumn, there are a big boost from continental Europe. So I reckon this one is just gaining as much energy as it can to make the flight over the North Sea and back to wherever it's come from.
Yeah, it must be. I mean, I know they're small birds, they're our smallest, but it does look a bit podgy.
Yeah, it does look a bit plump.
It's a bit circular.
Yeah. The fun fact, though, ornithologists used to think that goldcrests migrated by riding on the back of bigger birds, so geese or woodcock. And I wish that was true, because one image that would be of a goldcrest piloting a goose or a woodcock across across the North Sea.
Yeah.
Be amazing. But it's not true. They do make that journey by themselves, which, to be fair, is remarkable. They're tiny.
Yeah. I mean, if you didn't have kind of modern technology and modern knowledge and the ability to communicate over vast distances to where these birds migrate to, you would have no idea. You'd have to think of a way, like, where do these birds go in the autumn or winter, wherever, whenever they migrate? Where do they possibly go? They're so small. They surely can't cross an ocean. But there you go.
They do. Yeah. They can. Incredible. Now it's time for our first proper feature of the show, which we've called...
What the Fact?
Ribbit. What the Fact? Yes, the idea behind this is we're quite competitive, so we thought, why not have a little bit of a competition? So we've chosen a mutually decided theme, and we're each going to present our best facts or stories related to the theme, but it's down to you guys to choose the winner.
Yeah, that's right. So we are going to go head-to-head officially and see who has the best fact or story within the set category. And for this week, the set category is blood.
Mm.
Blood. So yeah, I'm excited to see what you know, James. I'm not sure you're going to top me, because I have got the cracker, the creme de la creme.
The cracker, okay.
The creme de la creme of blood facts for you, and I don't think you're going to know it.
That's fighting talk, that is.
It is fighting talk. I'm ready. Bring it on. But there is a caveat to this. The person who doesn't do as well on the poll that we will send out on social media, so you guys can decide and vote for your best fact or story, the person who doesn't do so well has to complete a forfeit.
Mm, this is where it gets exciting. You decide our fates, but we're hopefully going to suede our fates by giving good stories, but it's down to you guys. And should we pick a forfeit for this week?
I think so. I think we should go for the same one this time.
Oh, okay.
Just for ease, to ease us
in. Okay, fair.
Okay, so I did have an idea.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. So, obviously, we are up in northern Scotland at the minute, and we are surrounded by very beautiful but very cold rivers.
Oh, I know where this is going.
So I think that one of us, whoever loses, is going to have to take the plunge and go for a swim in the river, in minus temperatures.
Oh, yeah, that's fair. I mean, that's a good forfeit.
It's quite brutal.
It's freezing. Like, we did a New Year's Day dunk where we quickly got in the river and quickly got out again. So I think to because you're quite quick. You don't like to swim or anything like that. So I think we should have a time on how long we're in the water for.
I don't know. This is where I'm going to regret this decision.
I think so. Okay. So should we say 20 seconds?
20 seconds? Yeah. I mean, I know that doesn't seem like a long time, but when you're in ice cold water...
Yeah, I reckon... I think 30 seconds, but I was being kind.
What about 15?
Okay, 15 seconds.
Of swimming.
Of swimming. Okay, good. Yeah, 15 seconds of swimming ice cold water.
Okay.
The one who loses the forfeit has to take the plunge.
Okay, I'm confident with my fact, so fine.
Ugh.
Bring it on. I hope you've got your trunks ready. I hope you've packed your bag, because you're going swimming.
Right. Okay, do you want to go first?
I think I better have. I've built it up so much now. This is where I get nervous.
Yeah.
Okay, so my fact all around blood is actually more perhaps about camouflage. And I find camouflage really interesting, because when you think of camouflage, I mean, James, what do you think of when you think of something blending in with its environment?
Yeah, so something that matches the colour or the shape of its environment. So moths like the mottled beauty have a coloration to match trees, or you have things like the octopus, which can change its shape.
Yeah, exactly. And they all do that through changes of the skin. So octopus, for example, is a cephalopod. They're able to change the texture and colour of their skin amazingly, and very quickly as well. So that's a really smart way of camouflage. Birds do it, of course, sometimes by their plumage. Mottled plumage helps them blend into perhaps a woodland ecosystem, for example. They don't want to be too bright, too obvious. Then you're, of course, going to attract the attention of predators. But scientists at the Museum of Natural History in New York, specifically researcher Jesse Delia, has been looking into the camouflage of glass frogs.
Mm.
So when we're talking about camouflage in an aquatic environment, it can be very different from a terrestrial environment, especially when you're talking about transparency. So the ability to basically become invisible. Now, if you are an aquatic animal that solely remains in the water, it's slightly easier. We know of eels, for example, some fish species, able to turn themselves pretty much invisible except for some vital organs. And they can go unnoticed. It's the ultimate invisibility cloak, if you want. But for glass frogs, terrestrially, it's a lot harder. So for vertebrates, to achieve transparency is really difficult because of the circulatory system, where there's lots of hemoglobin, which contains red blood cells. And red blood cells, despite their namesake, actually absorb a lot of blue and green light. So when you cut yourself and blood, I mean, we do it as mammals, it's very red. And, you know, if you're going to be transparent, you can't really have obviously coloured blood.
Sure.
Because you, it was one thing making your skin transparent, it's another thing making your blood transparent. So glass frogs are already known for having really transparent muscles and skin, but how do they make their organs and blood transparent? I mean, that has been a question that has confused scientists for ages. So what the scientists have found is that they are able to regulate where their blood goes whilst they're asleep. So during the night, glass frogs are at their most active. That's when they're out hunting, but they're under the cover of darkness anyway, so they're not obvious to predators. But when it comes to the daytime, where they typically are their most vulnerable, because that's when they rest and go to sleep, they could be very obvious if they remained brightly coloured or, you know, not very cryptic. So what they're able to do is they're able to pull their blood from their surrounding organs, the red blood cells in particular, and move them into their liver. Now, by pulling the red blood cells into their liver, they're able to increase their transparency during the daytime only by 61%.
What?
So they become more invisible when they're asleep in the daytime than when they are active at night, where they need a lot more energy with their red blood cells floating around their muscles and everything else. But they're able to pull the red blood cells into their liver. They've still got blood, of course, in their bodies, but that's just mainly plasma. They reduce their metabolism and they become more invisible in the day.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool.
Yep.
So I'm guessing that the blood plasma doesn't have colour to it. Is that why it's invisible?
Yeah, no. So it's without pigment whatsoever. It's the red blood cells that give us that really vibrant red hue in our blood.
That's ridiculous. So what predators are out looking for glass frogs?
Well, anything that would take it, really. I mean, you've got birds, of course. A bird would happily take a frog. Snakes as well. So, you know, lots of different predators would happily kind of snack on a frog if they could find it. But, you know, with glass frogs, they are a really exciting example in evolution of how they've been able to really change their bodies to be able to go pretty much undetected. And I've actually got some photos here. And for you listening at home, I will put up this image on my social media. So do look at the hashtag the frogs bollocks to see this photo for yourself. But I thought you might be interested in it, James.
Yeah, show me.
So you've got the frog on the right-hand side, which is exercised. So this is a frog which has been going out feeding in the night. And you can see its organs and eyes particularly, but its whole body is quite green. It's quite obvious. Whereas the frog on the left-hand side is sleeping, you can see the darkness of its liver, where the red blood cells are maintained. But then you've got this body. I mean, especially look at the feet, look at the toe. I mean, yeah. I can't, it's barely even there. Except
it's incredible.
Except for an outline, it is invisible. And you've got these three frogs here on the leaf, which, except for the eyes, you'd have no clue that they were there.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, so it's 66%.
61.
61% more transparent.
Yeah, and it depends on the conditions and it depends on the frog. It's like 2 to 3-fold more transparent in the day by them being able to move their red blood cells around their body.
So they've cracked the mystery of how you get an invisibility cloak.
Yeah.
Is basically just absorb your red blood cells.
Pretty much. Well, put them into your liver. Hide them in your liver for a while.
It would have looked very different on Harry Potter if that was his method.
Could you imagine?
Just him straining like...
Suck them in! Yeah, no, that's maybe not the best look for them. But we're learning more about this kind of research all the time, and it's really useful for us because, you know, that has implications for medical human biology too.
Exactly. We can become invisible just like them.
Wahey!
Superpowers.
Cool.
Okay. That's actually really strong. I'm a little bit nervous now to go through mine.
Yeah, do your best, James. Do your best.
So my fact is, well, actually, I might be cheating on the first episode already, because I'm not doing one specific fact. I'm doing a kind of a collative of facts all to do with venom. So I'm talking about venom. Now, there are lots of different types of toxins in the natural world, venom of which being one form of toxin. And a lot of these different toxins have evolved separately. So we have water shrews, which are venomous, and they produce a venom that reacts in a similar way to the venom that's produced by the tarantula hawk wasp. So they both paralyze their victims, but they're, of course, not related at all. Mm-hmm. They both evolved completely differently, but their venom behaves in a very similar way.
Convergent evolution.
Convergent evolution, ooh, indeed. So first question is, what's the difference between venom and poison?
I know the answer to this one.
Go on.
So venom is something which is injected into the skin, whereas poison is something which can be absorbed.
Exactly. So for poison dart frogs, they don't have a venomous bite, but they do have poisonous skin, which is deadly when you touch them. But when you think of venom, you typically think of snakes. But different snakes possess lots of different types of venom. So you have hemotoxins, neurotoxins, cytotoxins, and they all affect their prey and us in various different ways. Now, I'm speaking quite broadly here because venoms are very complicated. And as I did more research, I got a headache. So I've broadened it to a kind of to different topics. So we're first going to talk about hemotoxins. So snakes like the African boom slang have hemotoxic venom. And broadly speaking, hemotoxic venoms affect your blood or blood vessels, and they affect your blood's ability to clot, which can result in massive tissue damage and organ failure. So pretty nasty stuff. Now, different snakes are more potent than others. So our European adder, it has a hemotoxic venom. But if you think about their prey, they're hunting small mammals, birds, so their venom doesn't need to be that potent in order to kill its prey. So when we get bitten by a European adder, the effect on our body is relatively minor. You know, in terms of deaths from a European adder, it's very few. There hasn't been a case for decades. Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't seek medical help, because if you get bitten by one, that venom will kind of be in your body and will get worse with time. So if you get bitten, you'll be fine so long as you go seek medical help. So that's,
or if your dog gets bitten.
Or if your dog gets bitten as well. Again, yeah. Probably be fine. Just go see the vet.
Or doctor if you're not a dog.
If you're not a dog, see a doctor. So now I mentioned the boom slang. So this is one of the most deadly snakes in Africa. Their venom is mostly hemotoxic and very potent, despite only hunting small animals. So it's so potent, it does cause deaths. Now, in 1957, an American herpetologist called Carl Schmidt was studying a young boom slang when he got bitten. Now, the bite wasn't very deep because their rear fangs didn't get a very good hold on his skin. But because he was a healthy guy, he thought, it'd be fine. There was nothing serious. I'm not going to seek any help. So instead, he decided just to keep a diary of his symptoms. Now, that diary actually turned out to be an initial autopsy report, because it didn't end well for Mr. Schmidt.
Oh, no.
So do you want to hear what happened to him?
Yeah, go on.
So he reported initially fever, vomiting, as you'd expect.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to feel good.
Next thing he reported, bleeding from his bowels.
Ugh, lovely.
And other gross stuff. Lots of gross things happened. And basically, within 24 hours, he did end up dying. Now, the actual autopsy report showed that he died from extensive internal bleeding. So he bled out, possibly from his anus, but actually it was his lungs that mostly bled out. But what's really interesting is the venom causes lots of different clots in the blood, but they're really, really tiny. Some can be big enough that it can cause a heart attack or it can cause a stroke, but most of these clots are so small that they can go through your body and doesn't really do much in terms of, you know, clotting big organs and big kind of processes. But what happens is all of these little clots add up, and eventually your body can no longer produce the clotting that it may need. So all of the damaged tissue, all of the damaged blood vessels end up bleeding profusely. And you can no longer stop that from happening. So that causes internal bleeding. And yeah, you eventually bleed out and die.
Well, that sucks.
So that sucks. Poor Carl Schmidt, he should have seen help. I mean, there are now anti-venoms for boom slangs, luckily. So the moral of the story is go seek help. Now, I'm going to mention another type of venom.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, further add to my fact. And next up, we have neurotoxins. So these are present in cobras, mambas, taipans, kind of the most deadliest snakes we have in the world. I'm going to talk about black mambas because their venom is incredibly potent. And again, they only really hunt small mammals, but they also get hunted. So their venom is acting as not only a way to predate their animals, but also as a defense from other predators.
Yep, smart.
Very smart. So what the venom is basically doing is it's wanting to immobilize its victim. So if it's its prey, it wants to be able to immobilize it, stop it in its tracks so it can then eat it, and the same for its predator. It wants to be able to stop it in its tracks so the mamba itself doesn't get eaten. Now, how the neurotoxin works is it basically quickly and dramatically messes with the nervous system. You know, our bodies, normal animal bodies, have lots of different nerve cells which communicate with each other through the synapses, and the neurotoxin basically stops that communication. So your brain might say, move your arm. But then if it's inhibited, there's nothing to say, stop moving your arm or move your arm back. So effectively, you become paralyzed. Your body just stiffens up and therefore its prey or its predator cannot move. Now, that might not really be very helpful if you then want to digest the animal, because if it's stuck in a really weird position, the mamba will have a really difficult time swallowing its prey. So there are actually these slow-acting neurotoxins which go one step further and destroy the nervous system altogether. So it's not telling its body to move in one direction or another. It's basically just saying, there's no nerves, there's no nothing. So the body just goes limp.
And
goes really floppy, which then means it's much easier for the mamba to swallow its prey whole. And that's neurotoxins to a rough kind of degree. So venom acts not only as a way to kill something, but also acts as a way of digestion. The venom can actually work and start breaking down the animal from the inside, as well as obviously the snake's stomach digesting it from the outside. And that is the story of venom.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, what fascinates me about the black mamba in particular is the fact, of course, it consumes the prey which it has injected venom into. So it's remarkable that this, its own body, doesn't feel the effects when it's digesting the prey which has the venom in it. That's really interesting and really cool and makes me really love them. And do you know what? I've met a black mamba.
Have you?
I have done. Because the way they hunt is, well, they can basically, they'd like to get above their prey. So I was once working in Namibia for a while, and we were out on a game drive, and we'd parked the car, and we were, funnily enough, talking about snakes, and we started talking about all the different types of mambas and all of the, you know, less aggressive, less dangerous snakes that there are out there, when I looked up, and literally on a branch above my head was a black mamba.
Phenomenal.
Beautiful snake.
Oh, I'd love to see one.
Gorgeous. Absolutely. In the sunlight, they're kind of iridescent and they're all these beautiful colours. We did move the car quite quickly because they will approach from above. But in fact, when we were guiding recently as well, weren't we, in the Gambia with a wonderful guy called Malik. And he said in Bruford Forest that he always has to wear a hat because he's bald and he's got a shiny head, and he said that the green mamba is attracted to his shiny head.
It's brilliant. I love that story. And it's particularly funny because he's terrified of snakes, an incredible naturalist. Yeah. But terrified of snakes,
one of the best guides in the world absolutely when it comes to birds, but he's a little bit nervous about snakes. Yeah. So he had to wear his hat in the scorching sun. Yeah. In Bruford Forest in Gambia. But
so there you go. A little bit of snake appreciation and respect, because they are beautiful animals, incredibly, you know, adapted, but they can be quite scary. Now, also just as a little caveat, a lot of the times snakes do what are called false bites, where they'll bite you but they won't actually envenomate you, because it's a very precious substance. The animal's not there to eat you, so why waste the venom to bother killing you?
No.
So only if you're in a very stupid situation will you really get, you know, the nasty effects of the venom, or if you accidentally stand on one. So, you know, don't be afraid, but be very vigilant.
Yeah, and I bet Mr. Schmidt really mm-hmm. wished he was born in 2024 when this research about glass frogs had come out.
Oh,
because
okay.
now, uh-huh. You see what I'm doing here?
Yeah, I see what you're doing.
Yeah. Because now they're using this research about how glass frogs are able to clot their blood in their liver and kind of unclot it again
yeah.
to look at human research about yeah. blood clots and trying to save lives by looking through glass frog biology.
Very good. I like what you've done there.
Thank you very much.
You've manipulated the system. So, yeah, those are our two facts for this week based on the topic of blood. We're going to post this on Twitter. Well, we're going to post a poll on our Twitter, so you can follow us at James E.G. Stevens or Megan McCubbin. So yeah, do go to our Twitters and cast your vote, and the loser will take the plunge.
I really hope it's not me.
Oh, me neither.
Oh, but if you also know a better way of polling or perhaps a kinder platform that will reach a big audience, then do let us know, because this is the best way we could think of, but very happy for your input too.
Not too long ago, we reached out on social media asking for your questions. Now I think, Megan, you've got a few lined up.
I do. So we picked out a few that have been sent in to us. I'm not sure this one... We're going down a bit of a theme here with this one.
Mm.
Is there an animal you've ever been injured by?
Ah.
This was sent to us by Hannah on Instagram.
Many.
Mm.
I've been injured by many animals. Not necessarily through doing something stupid, just through coincidences. Which one should I go for? The one that I dine out most on is I have been charged and attacked and flipped by a rhinoceros.
Oh, for goodness sake.
No,
no,
it's true.
James.
It's a real story. I got charged and flipped and mauled by a rhinoceros called Lecco. And it was scarring in many ways. You know, it's hard for me to tell this story. Yeah, basically, it came over and ran at me and flipped me in the air. And I'm what, 80 odd kilos? And I landed right on the back of my pelvis, so it really hurt. But luckily, I'm here to tell the story. I was very brave, and I got up straight away, and I punched it in the face. Ran off. We fought more, and I won. I beat Lecco, and that's my biggest accomplishment: is that I fought a rhinoceros and won. And that's time for the podcast. That's the end of the show. You're not allowed to contribute in this story in any way. Moving on.
Lecco was a little baby.
No, he wasn't a baby.
He was a little baby.
Big. He was massive.
Lecco was a calf. He's now a very big
male. He was a sub-adult. He was a big boy.
He was not a big boy.
He was. I mean, he was okay. Right.
He was quite small. I mean, he mainly stood less than a meter off the ground.
Every time we tell the story, you make it smaller and smaller.
He was the size of a thumbnail. A thumble. That's what I can say. The size of a thumble.
No, he okay.
Lecco was an embryo.
Shut up. He was massive.
He's an embryo.
Okay, but he was 355 kilos of subadult rhino.
Yeah.
Now, if you've ever seen a rhino, they can get to many, many tons.
Well, he is now.
He's a big boy now.
He's a very big boy.
The photo that I used to show people of the rhino that I got attacked by. This very one.
And wasn't also attacked. He was being a bit playful with
you. He was being playful. This was at a rhino orphanage in South Africa. And we've both done some work with a lovely charity called Helping Rhinos. And we went in there to film young Lecco, who'd sadly became an orphan because his mum was poached. And we were there kind of just washing him and getting some shots with the camera. Luckily, I'd put the camera down, and then Lecco decided, you know what, I want to have a bit of a play fight. He chose me as a very worthy opponent, and he basically just flipped me right onto my ass, and it really hurt. And yeah,
he was very sweet. He loved little scratches. He had a little goat friend.
What was the goat friend called again?
Oh, it was something like Mary, but it was
male.
Yeah, I know it was.
That's right.
So originally when we went to Zululand Rhino Orphanage, there was just Lecco there. Now there's many more orphans there now, but they're all doing at the moment pretty well. And big shout out to Helping Rhinos, who, by the way, are having their 12th birthday today, actually, the day of recording. So 12 years old, doing brilliant kind of conservation work out there. So
yeah, amazing. You know.
Great, great charity, great organisation.
Now I've got a question for you that was sent to us by Robbie G15. Because apparently Susie Dent would like to invent a word that describes the joy of hearing birdsong.
Right, and there isn't one.
I don't believe so, no.
Okay, because there's some amazing kind of ancient words that are connected to nature when you look back in the history books. But
yeah, there's a lot that we've lost. Certainly in the Gaelic culture, there's a lot more words that are related to nature and our connection to them. But in the English language, not so much.
God, tricky. Okay, a joyful word for hearing bird song.
Do you want a moment to think about it? And through the magic of editing, we'll come back with a word.
Okay, ready? Okay, I've got two.
Okay.
I'm going to treat you to two.
Two?
Okay. Yeah. So I think the first one's the best one, which is aviphoria.
Oh, that's strong.
So it's like avian euphoria.
Yeah.
But combine it. Aviphoria.
Smart. You could become a lexicographer.
What's that?
There's people who studies words.
Oh.
The study of words.
I don't know the study of words. I'm not very good at that. That's what Susie does. Excellent, yeah. Susie. Lovely Susie. Okay, word number two. It's a bit more silly, this one. Harmon chirp.
Harmon chirp.
Harmon chirp.
Harmon chirp.
Like harmony.
Yeah.
And chirping.
Wow.
Harmon chirp.
A harmon chirp. I mean, that is... That
I've been enjoying the harmon chirps.
Sure.
If you want to use it in a sentence.
I think AV... What was it?
Aviphoria.
Aviphoria. Is it AV or AVI? So it's avian, isn't it? So
avian, yeah.
Aviphoria. Okay. I've got my own. Avium Laetitia.
What on earth does that mean?
Latin.
No.
I just compiled some Latin words together to get a rough translation of the joy of birds. Avium Laetitia.
Well, it's not very memorable.
Wow, it's beautiful though.
Just it is.
As beautiful as the birds. Avium Laetitia.
Avium Laetitia. Well, I'm not going to do
that. You
don't
do the accent, but yeah.
But I don't... Yeah.
Doesn't roll off the tongue as much as...
No.
Aviphoria. Aviphoria.
Aviphoria. It was aviphoric.
Aviphoric.
Yeah, you know, so like you've euphoric.
You've got the past participle for aviphoria.
You've got multiple uses.
No, Avium Laetitia is way nicer.
Nah.
Exotic.
Rubbish. Now it's time for us to introduce our very first esteemed guest of the podcast. This person happens to be a very good friend of mine. We've spent many hours, often in the early hours of the morning, freezing our fingers and toes off, hoping, waiting desperately for this little prickly friend to appear. He's an excellent science communicator, an excellent author, an excellent conservationist. It is the one and only Hugh Warwick, aka Hedgehog Hugh.
Hi, Megan and James. Thank you for inviting me along to be a part of this. So, who am I and what do I do? My name is Hugh Warwick. I've studied hedgehogs for nearly 40 years. I'm a spokesperson for the British Hedgehog Preservation Society, though I am not speaking on their behalf now. And I write books. Oh, and campaign on behalf of hedgehogs. I don't write books just about hedgehogs, though. I write books about other things. And in fact, 28th of March, Cull of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation, leaps onto the shelf. So there you go, a few things that I do. Now, is the one thing I wish people knew about my study species. Well, actually, this is the thing I do spend a lot of time telling people about, so maybe you've heard it already. But the hedgehog. The hedgehog is often underappreciated as this fantastic, amazing species. In fact, I go so far as to argue that the hedgehog is the most important creature on the planet. And this is because we've got the capacity to get close to it. It's not magic, it's not woo, it's because the hedgehog has no fight or flight response. It means that we've got an opportunity with this species to get really close without risk of losing a nose or it just running away. And the importance for that is that moment of connection. Those moments of connection, I think, are absolutely vital. Finding something which is really, really precious. So the hedgehog is vital because it gives us that moment of connection. And that is important because, well, the American writer Stephen Jay Gould said, "We will not fight to save what we do not love." And talking about conservation, and most of the conservation and wildlife groups, David Attenborough, all those people, they think that we can get people to fall in love with nature through the charismatic megafauna. But I know it's got to be something a little more accessible than that. Relying on elephants and tigers, whales and dolphins is relying on supermodels for your idea of what human relationships should be like. In the end, we'll fall in love with the girl or the boy next door, and The hedgehog is the animal equivalent. Now, I've been involved with some hedgehoggy things for so very long. Many odd things have happened along the way, but probably the strangest was being invited to go and talk in America at the Rocky Mountain Hedgehog Show, at the great sort of pet convention of hedgehog lovers over in the United States. These are not the European hedgehogs, but African species of hedgehog, the Atelurix genus. And I was invited to speak there whilst they all decided which was the cutest looking pet hedgehog. And yes, that was weird, but it wasn't as weird as what happened afterwards. They then asked me if I'd like to stay for the International Hedgehog Olympic Games, and or IHOG as it's known. And for a brief moment I thought maybe they were joking, but there really is an International Hedgehog Olympic Games, though they've changed the name now because the IOC was a bit concerned about perception of endorsement. And it's a very strange event. It's not really Olympic Games, it's more of a triathlon where the hedgehogs do the sprint inside a hamster ball. You're not allowed to clap because it upsets them, but you can do jazz hands to show your appreciation. The hurdles, quite a challenge for an animal not normally predisposed to jumping. And finally, the most esoteric of the disciplines, the floor exercises, where the hedgehog had to go over a teeter-totter through a tunnel and, for reasons which nobody could adequately explain, knock over a My Little Pony. Strange things with the hedgehogs, you know. And finally, if I was all powerful for a day and could do one thing to help the environment, what would it be? Well, actually, it's quite simple. I would just make sure that every single person on the planet had a positive, amazing connection and moment with a species, with nature. Now, obviously, the hedgehog is easily the best and the most wonderful of these things, but there may not be enough to go around. So maybe it'll be somebody having the first time in their life having a robin land on the hand to take a mealworm, or finding a toad under a rock and looking into those beautiful jeweled eyes and suddenly noticing and really seeing quite how special and magical nature can be. Maybe just one of these moments for every single person on the planet would be enough to shift us from just liking to loving the natural world. And as I mentioned earlier, that's where the revolution begins. Thanks.
Oh, I've got such big love for Hugh. The work that he does is brilliant. And I think he's got such a point there about kind of starting a revolution, whether that's externally or internally, because of our love for nature and just connecting with it more.
Yeah, one absolute legend. No, he makes some really good points there. The more we can do with that connection with nature, the better it will be for us and the planet.
Yeah, I find sometimes when the world gets a bit too much, things get a bit too big, that actually just stepping outside in my garden and regrounding myself by listening to the birds or seeing what's scuttling around in the undergrowth really helps me, makes me feel good. And then I'm more motivated to do something. And if, for example, you are someone with a garden, if you're lucky enough to have one, that wants to do something for hedgehogs, there are a few top tips that you can do.
Yeah, that's right. In order to encourage wildlife and hedgehogs into your garden, often it's just a really simple thing of letting your garden go wild. Let a corner of your garden just grow. Don't mow it down. You could cut a hole in your fence to provide a hedgehog highway, add some water, add a little pond. There's loads of different things that you can do to encourage hedgehogs. And Hugh, on his social media, has loads of different tips in order to do so.
Yeah, exactly. Check him out if you haven't already and look out for his upcoming book. But I love hedgehogs. I mean, it's no wonder that they're Britain's favourite mammal, really, is it? I mean, there's little button noses and the little spikes. Ooh. And the little waddle.
They're so cute. I've done lots of filming in hedgehog hospitals before and they're just the most adorable things. Little prickly little friends.
I know, but it's incredibly sad, obviously, because they were relisted as threatened. So the more that we can do, the better.
Yeah, exactly. I can't remember the last time I saw a hedgehog, alive at least. It's been many, many, many years.
No, I mean, we don't have many near us, do we, up here in Scotland? No. But that being said, my mum has some and she lives in quite urban Southampton, in a very kind of built up area. The irony is, the moment you go into the New Forest, absolutely none, or none that I see anyway. Yeah. I'm sure there are some hiding away somewhere, but it's amazing that they're doing better actually in our towns and cities than they are in our countryside.
Yeah, it's a real shame. But no, hopefully just by rewilding your garden, doing the little things, we can make a difference and bring back the hedgehog to our beautiful countryside.
Absolutely. Power to the people.
So that's it. That's episode one done. Can you believe it?
I know. We've finally done it.
And quickly, thank you so much to our wonderful friends, Gemma Shooter, who created the Frog's Bollocks artwork, and Kirsty North for the lovely harp interludes.
And of course, a huge thank you for tuning in as well. You can send in your stories and questions to info@thefrogsbollocks.com or follow us on social media. On Instagram, I'm @MeganMcCubbinWild.
And I'm james.stevens.photography.
And if you're gutted and you really can't wait a week for the next episode, don't worry, because you don't have to, because episode 2 is available to listen to now. But thank you very much for tuning in to the Frogs Bollocks podcast, and we will see you next time. You are the Frogs Bollocks.